Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Why is Heritage Radio Network important to you?
HRN is very nostalgic to go into because it's really the only place that you have this really warm, homey experience to watch people get together and talk about the things that really make a difference.
It's really fun when I ask guests, do you want to be on Heritage? And they're like, at Roberta's? Yes, 100%.
I believe that we all are really trying to bring people together.
I think getting more people excited about good, local, well-crafted food and away from big ag and tasteless commodity food is so important.
It's kind of an honor to be sitting there with somebody in a space where so many other people have sat.
Join HRN's vibrant community of thoughtful eaters. Become a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer, the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Sonoko Sakai, who is a cooking teacher, noodle maker, food writer, and a green activist based in LA and Tehachapi in Southern California. Sonoko just published Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors, and it is really literally covers everything you'd like to know about the basics of Japanese food. So today we'll discuss how Sonoko's unique childhood inspired her to build her career in food, her passion for preserving ancient grains, a new book, of course, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. Also, if you have any ideas about the topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. So let's start a conversation with Sonoko Sakai. Hello, Sonoko. Welcome.
Hello.
So some of the listeners suggested that I should definitely have you on the show. So finally, I'm very excited.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So welcome. And you're on book tour right now.
Yes, I am. It's such a nice reason to be in New York.
Right. Yes. So it's cold, but still. So first of all, so I heard that you had a very unique childhood living in different cities. Mm-hmm. So where did you live and how each place influenced you to become who you are now?
Well, I was born in New York City. I was one of the first of five children to be born here in the United States.
Mm.
And my father worked for Japan Airlines. He was the first generation of employees that was sent abroad after the war. So this was in times when Japan was still in recovery mode from the war, and the sentiment was a little different. But here my young father and my mother with my brother and then me and then my sister, we started our family here in New York, and we were here for about 4 years. And then we got transferred back to Tokyo, and my father was running the international side of Japan Airlines, so then he got transferred again to San Francisco, and then he got transferred again to Mexico City, where I spent actually 4 years of my life. And then back to Japan, where I lived with my grandmother in Kamakura, outside of Tokyo, until our house in Tokyo was ready to be moved in. So I spent a formative years in Mexico City and Kamakura, and then eventually in Tokyo. And then after finishing junior high school and part of high school, we came back to Los Angeles. My father did one more overseas assignment, and this is basically where I am right now.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of moving around.
So you can speak Japanese, English, and Spanish.
Right,
as well.
Right. Wow. They're all mixed up.
I'm just curious, though. You know, the Mexico is an interesting element, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the Mexican element in your side?
The Mexican element is... when I'm in Japan, I crave for tacos, you know, for a good like a, you know, homemade tortillas or something. And when I'm in L.A., I really want some good natto and soba. So I think a lot of it is culinary, but a lot of the singing, my music came from growing up singing Mexican songs, but. I think my grandmother, being in Kamakura and growing up with my grandmother next door, had a major influence in establishing my identity as a Japanese person and looking at the traditional life.
Right.
That is very, you know, very much disappearing today because she comes from the Meiji the Meiji era. So that's gone, right?
Right.
So I had an awakening in Kamakura as far as my Japanese cultural identity is concerned.
Right. So for listeners who are not familiar with Kamakura, Kamakura still is a very historic city.
Yes.
And very special. And I watched a video about your life in Kamakura when you grew up, like craftsmanship.
Yes, craftsmanship. There's also, it's the third oldest capital of Japan and known for the Zen Buddhism to flourish in that city. So there's lots of temples and shrines, and there's the sea. And because there are many temples and shrines, there's also a lot of craftsmen that served the you know, that made the tofu. And there's good tea. There was a tea ceremony in different places happening all the time, including my grandmother's house, and incredible seafood. And artisans working on carving Buddhist sculptures and making tatami mats and fishmongers and tofu makers. Anyway, every day I really was exposed to the craftsmanship, and that was not really unusual back in the 60s, but it was an amazing time.
Mm. Right. So it sounds like it's in you. You kind of inherited that kind of craftsmanship.
Yes, it's my treasure that I actually got to see these people working every day with their hands. And I'm not really a craftsman, but I wanted to see how I could preserve that with words or with the foods I cook or with the things I source or, you know, how I share Japanese culture.
Right. So we'll discuss the book in a moment, but your book is full of that mindset of craftsmanship, and I really enjoy even, you know, before the show we discussed that how much, you know, even one recipe has some element of craftsmanship. I really found it.
Oh, is that right? Thank you so much. Yeah.
So it's beyond, far beyond the book. Well, you know, one book, cookbook. So we'll discuss it in a moment.
Yeah.
But I was curious, so when did you move back to the U.S.? I mean, you said 40 years ago?
Yes, in the 70s, my father was transferred to Los Angeles, and I was a junior in high school.
Mm.
So it was kind of a hard transition for me because I was so used to being Japanese and going to school in Japan and trying to figure out how to acculturate to the U.S. American culture.
Mm.
But it's actually ended up being the place where I've lived the most.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Well, as far as I know, you're very balanced, like 50-50, you know, Japanese-ness and non-Japanese-ness.
Yeah.
At your core, you have a very strong Japanese element in you. So.
Yes, yes. I take a lot of pride in that you know, Japanese-ness of me, but I'm also very American.
Mm.
And I'm a little Mexican, too, when I want to be, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so cool. Well, you got into cooking.
Yes.
And according to your book, I really enjoyed reading again, but you grew up with your grandmother, mother, you're always into cooking.
Right, yeah. Well, I think all grandmothers were basically home cooks.
Mm.
Mothers were home cooks. Not too many women worked. Well, actually, she did some She was a teacher, English teacher, but by the time I met her, she was already retired. So she was in the kitchen, and I could smell wonderful things coming out of that kitchen. She was not only a good Japanese cook, but she also baked bread and cakes, and she was probably the only person in Kamakura that owned an oven.
Oh, wow.
A Western oven, a tiny one, but a lot of things came out of that oven. And my sister actually became a pastry chef, and I'm the one that I thought I was going to become a pastry chef, but I just became more of a savory home cook. But we had everything from sourcing the ingredients directly from the fishermen or going into a rice shop and watching the miller mill rice. These are all things that is by tagging along my grandmother and seeing how she selected ingredients. And I think it was a substantial part of my culinary education.
Right. And so I also heard that you used to be a foreign film buyer.
Yes.
Where is it in the picture of who you like?
Well, I actually spent more than 20 years in film. Mm. And I was at UCLA teaching. I was in education. Actually, I thought I would become a foreign service, like a diplomat. Mm. I always wanted to work in international relations without understanding what that really meant. So when I came out of college, I really just found myself having all kinds of not very useful courses behind me. And, you know, I was not quite a businesswoman or anything like that. But my parents wanted me to come back and get married, but I just said, I'm just going to continue in graduate school, but I had to figure out how to make a living. So I started working in the film school at UCLA, which actually was an incredible education, because not only did I find my voice in English, but I started looking at beautiful films and photography, and also I realized that there's this whole universe out there of interesting stories from all over the world. So I kind of deviated from being in education to being in working in films. And as a film seller, selling rights, film rights, to buying rights for the Japanese market. But I always had in mind food. Like, I could travel and I could eat good food. I could go to the first thing I would do when I was at the film markets, like in France or Italy, I would just go to the market. First, I would just like figure out where the farmers markets were. And this is where I devoted most of my time, in the bakeries.
Wow. So yeah. I could clearly see there's a past coming to this point.
Yeah, but I thought it was all important. You know, I should know about the wines. I should know about good food, which helps me find good stories. And it's just all part of my education. I'm all connecting all these dots together and turning this into my own story. So I don't think I wasted any time doing film.
Yeah, so, well, and I understand you are such a good storyteller from, I think I've never attended your classes, but also you really communicate, and in your book it's so obvious, so.
Well, it took me a long time, though. It wasn't easy. You know, the last book I did was 35 years ago when my son was born. So I actually spent a lot of time thinking about this thing, and I needed to mature myself as a person, as a cook, and I don't think I was, if you asked me 10 years ago, write another cookbook, I don't think I could have produced the same thing. You know, it's just my insight was, I think, a little shallower. Yeah, I needed this experience of, you know, learning about food and the people who grow it.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's not just on food on the plate. So.
No.
I wanted to share with the audience that, you know, when you wrote your first book, there's a nice story of your film teacher, I think.
In the first one?
Right.
You in the introduction, you mean?
Somebody asked you to write a book. I mean, suggested.
Oh, yeah. So that was my professor at UCLA. And I was working in the film department in his photography studio. And he was a documentary filmmaker, Lou Stuman. And I was his assistant, and he was also teaching screenwriting, and I would occasionally bring bento boxes to him, you know, and he just was fascinated by my cooking. And he said, Well, Sunoco, you should maybe write a cookbook. Maybe you could find your voice through your kitchen. You're so comfortable cooking. So I thought, you know, that might be really the gateway, the doorway into finding my voice in English. Because as I explained to you earlier, I grew up in so many different places. I had this multicultural personality with all these languages flying all over me in my dreams and in real life. So I said, okay, this is a way I could focus on improving my English language. And so I started writing this book, and he helped me.
Mm.
It was an amazing experience. It took me, you know, 3 years, but I did. That's how I wrote my first cookbook.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the bento must have been really good, convincing.
Oh, I was in my late 20s and daring to write a cookbook, but it did get published. And it was maybe a little bit early for me to do this in the early and the mid-80s. People were starting to learn about Japanese food, sushi, right? Sushi became very big, and Japanese economy was boosting. But nobody thought of Japanese home cooking. People thought Japanese food is something you eat at a restaurant,
right,
from someone, an expert, you know, sushi chef or kaiseki. And nobody even thought of breaking the myth of Japanese home cooking.
Mm.
And not too many Japanese people living that here, I guess.
Right.
Or maybe a little bit, but it was still, I think there was still a veil of mystery.
Mm. Right. I think even still now, though.
Yeah.
Right. So you are, you know, you didn't say you are like, you know, officially trained or something, but I think you have a very strong philosophy of cooking. So
yeah.
What is that?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do from growing up in California, spending time in California. One of the people that we met were Japanese American farmers. They were really kind to us and invited us to their farms, and we went hunting for like sea urchins before it got kind of more difficult to do it on a casual level, but you know, making hoshigaki, you know, dry persimmons. These were first generation of Japanese American people that were preserving the tradition. A lot of it that was fading in Japan.
Mm.
And so I think my cooking interest even broadened when I really started learning from these people and also seeing how they were adapting to this country without having always to rely on Japanese things from, you know, Japanese ingredients from Japan.
Mm.
So just from being just an authentic Japanese home cook, or I became more of a flexible home cook, learning from different sources and sourcing things from the farmer's market or from my farmer friends. And I think I really matured in the years that I started rooting myself in California.
Mm, right. So local, sustainable. That's to me comes.
Yeah,
to mind.
And local and sustainable is a word that has become very popular in the last, 10, 15 years. But we never use that kind of word. Japan has always been a bit about sustainability, about not wasting.
Mm.
You know, my mother, grandmother lived through several wars, or especially my grandmother. She says she's lived through like 3 or 4 wars. And which ones are those? And she's like, World War One. And Korean War, World War II. But things were always scarce. And so she was about frugality. And my mother was about, you know, living through hunger, you know. Mm-hmm. So she did not like waste. And so that was, economy was very important part of the principle. But also we looked for seasonality. We looked for seasonality and freshness and beauty. You know, you just don't, you know, pile up your plate. I mean, these are principles that I have learned as you know, as a basic part of my cooking philosophy.
Mm.
But also there's other things that nicely wrap up in fives, and I talk about it in my cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
But about Japanese, I think cooks all have this five different groups of five principles. It's called Gogyosetsu. If you're Japanese, Chinese people call it Wuxing, but you would already know like the five basic senses, right? And sour, sweet, salty, you know, bitter, and then there's umami also, so maybe there's six senses, but there's also five colors. Very important when you're cooking that you're not just using white bread, right? You want to, it's white, red, yellow, green, black. These are, if you start thinking in terms of how you plate your dishes or the kind of ingredients that you use for cooking, then you are diversifying the way you cook and bringing more nutrients to your plate. So I always think about making sure that there's balance and harmony in my cooking. So, and different skills, like, you know, you could cut, and we like to just cut and slice raw if it's a very fresh piece of fruit. You don't want to fuss with it too much. You just want to eat it straight. But there's also steaming, there's grilling or searing, and there's braising or simmering. So learning these basic techniques, five techniques, is very useful for a home cook. You don't have to be a master, you know, sushi chef or anything, but variety is something that, and deep frying, you know, you shouldn't be scared. And I encourage people to try frying tempura, for example, and it's fun. It's fun to do. And so I'm always encouraging my students to think in terms of these five concepts. And I keep going into other directions too, you know, and let's say that even temperature, you know, temperature of how you serve your meal. You should, you know, serve hot things hot, cold things cold. I talked about portions, but also the atmosphere of the table setting. You know, you want to sit by a window. My grandmother's always like setting the table, even if it was for one person. Very important that you just don't eat out of a pot. You know, or putting like chopsticks and raise the chopsticks from directly from placing it on the table. Just put something to rest your chopsticks, or also just your mood. You know, if you are in a good mood as a cook, you actually make other people feel better. It should not be an obligation. It should be a joy.
Right.
So these are elements that I wrap up in five that I think it's very important thing that should play out while you're cooking.
That's so important.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we get so caught up in the busyness of everyday life that you just want to put food on the table. I don't like to approach food that way. You have to treat your ingredients with respect.
Right.
And everybody only has, you know, a given amount of time, right? And I like to use I think time is precious, and we want to respect our ingredients.
And even if you're so stressed out, by having, say, it's just like, you know, making a good cup of coffee, you have a break and you have great nutritious food.
Yeah.
It's not just kind of meditating, but also you get nutrition.
Yes. Right. I think it really is very wholesome that way. And it makes you feel better, I think.
I think this is one thing that's very symbolic of what you do. I heard you like making soba noodles,
which is
simple, nutritious, and kind of meditating. So,
yeah.
So why did you get into making buckwheat soba noodles?
Yeah. Well, if you ask any person in Japan, do you make soba noodles at home?
It's looking insane. No.
It's probably a no, right? Do you make udon noodles at home? Maybe, right? That's more common. Do you make ramen noodles at home? Never, right? I do all three. And because I've lived overseas in the United States most of my life, I always craved for really fresh noodles. And I've depended on dried noodles. But I was never happy with the dried soba noodles, which is mostly made with wheat, like 70% wheat, and they still call it soba noodles. And I said, no. So I was thinking one day while I was still working in the film business, I actually produced this one film that flopped. It was one of the few movies I made, but it was a big flop because it opened during the week of the crash.
Okay.
And I was really disappointed and really sad and financially in a disaster. But I said, okay. And I went back to Japan, and for comfort, I went for a slurp of my favorite soba noodles. And I felt so restored. And I was just thinking, God, what if I just put my my hands in flour and water and just learn how to make some noodles and see how that exercise will do. It's very rote. It's just mixing water and flour, but you have to pay attention to the ingredients. So it's meditation. It's like, and I started taking some workshops, and you know, and I would start coming back to Japan to do this, and then I even went and apprenticed with, you know, just an estage with a Michelin soba maker in Tokyo, and my father was like so angry. He's like, "Why are you wasting your time and throwing out your career, your, you know, 20-year career in film and doing this?" I said, "Because I just want to restore myself. I need to do something different. Mm-hmm. I think film was great. It was great. I did it for a long time, but I think I'm ready to do something that's more tactile, that I get my hands in something and I slow down and I have control." Or even with soba, you don't have full control. You know, if you don't pay attention to the ingredients, you could end up with a noodle that's going to fall apart. So it's for health reasons, I went and started making noodles to slow down. And it's so good. Yeah.
Right. I think, like you said, maybe, you know, making a pizza dough is another craft, but, you know, soba is so flaky and, you know, it's just so hard to make, and I never even tried myself.
Oh, it's easy. It's easy. I think there's a myth about soba making, and they put it on a pedestal, but I think if you try it, it's not that hard.
Okay.
It may not look that great in the beginning, but with practice, you could actually get really good at it, and I actually, even while in New York, I did like three sessions of soba making with people who've never made soba before. They all made really beautiful noodles. And I teach every weekend a variety of classes in Los Angeles and elsewhere. Also King Arthur Flour in Vermont and Seattle. And most people have never made soba before, but most people go home with noodles. It's really amazing.
Wow. So listeners, it's worth trying making
soba
noodles.
It's like food medicine. It's a full protein. Buckwheat is a full protein. Buckwheat in this country has always been treated sort of like a green manure, and farmers use it as a rotation crop, and they don't even let it grow to seed. But the bees love the flowers, and it's not a wheat. It's a gluten-free plant that is related to the rhubarb plant. And it's a beautiful seed, a pseudo grain that makes incredible flour that's smooth, and it's good for your digestion. And we say blood cleansing, you know, it cleanses your blood. And in New Year's, on New Year's Eve, everybody in Japan eats soba noodles for longevity and good luck. And they don't eat, they put ramen aside, udon aside. They just eat soba noodles.
That's true. Yeah, so in the Edo period, you know, they're so milled down, and processed rice was so popular among rich people. So they got beriberi.
They
ate buckwheat, and then they became healthy
again, right? Yeah, the refined foods, white foods, don't do you much good, you know? You want to go browner, you know, you want the whole grain or the whole seed. And I think that's the movement that is happening right now, is to lean more towards less processed food.
Okay, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we talk about Sonoko's ancient grain passion as well as her cookbook. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
You listen to Heritage Radio Network because, let's face it, you have really good taste. You care about where your food comes from, who made it, and its impact on the planet. Whether you're looking for an inspiring interview with your favorite celebrity chef, the latest on Dave Arnold's Spinzall, or if you want to get down and dirty with some agricultural policy, we've got you covered. 10 years in and 13,000 episodes later, HRN continues to be the go-to media outlet for thoughtful eaters like you. And we never could have done it without the support of our listeners. Help Food Radio continue in the future and help us raise enough funds for the year to come. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And since you've got such good taste, we have some very cool member gifts for you to choose from. Thanks for listening and for being a part of the HRN community.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Sonoko Sakai, who is a cookbook teacher, noodle maker, food writer, and a grain activist based in LA, and Tehachapi in Southern California. So she just published the wonderful cookbook, Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. So let's talk about your book. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a great title, Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. That's exactly what's in the book. So what's the theme of sort of, in other words, why did you want to write this book?
Well, I felt that it has been 30 years or more than 30 years since I wrote my first book. And I just, I was at an age where my grandmother was when I first walked into her kitchen.
Mm.
And she always used to say, I'm like living history. And I felt like I was starting to feel like living history because I remember my grandmother, who's from another era, and my parents were from another era, and I just felt like I need to write down these traditions. Mm. And again, entering the kitchen is the simplest and the most authentic way to start as someone who's really interested in food. And so I felt that was missing. I felt like that was missing 35 years ago, but I thought I could write better with this experience that I've gained. And so I started writing. Mm. Yeah.
So this book is a lot. Like every page has some kind of message.
Yeah. So the first book, even though there's a lot of philosophy in it, I was still very young and I wasn't thinking I'm going to make miso from scratch. I'm going to make udon from scratch. You really don't see anything made from scratch. Right. Maybe some pickles, but it's more recipe and ideas, which I still believe in. The principles I believe in, but I thought I just want to take it a step deeper. As a home cook, what can we do at home here in America in a way that it's authentic to us?
Mm.
And soybeans, we grow it here. You know, most of the soybeans are grown here in the United States. A lot of them are GMO, but I found a source for non-GMO, and I learned how to make miso and tofu, and it sounds like a very laborious thing. Yes, it's a little bit more time in the kitchen, but that's the way people used to do it. Like the Japanese American obachan, ojichan, the grandmas, you know, and the grandpas, that's the way they did everything.
Mm.
And I wanted to share that with like the next generation of people, of Japanese Americans, but also a lot of people that are non-Asians will come to me and they say, well, you know, I've traveled to Japan or I just love Japanese food. How could I make it at home? And I want to teach them how to make it from scratch. And it's not the artisan way. It's just as a home cook, that's the way home cooks used to do everything, from the noodle making to miso making to the pickle making. We didn't rely on processed convenient foods, right? Unfortunately, that's becoming more popular, but I don't want to go there, including making the stock. I like to make it from scratch.
Right. And the book is, of course, it's really beautiful. Like, pictures are like, you know, like a coffee table book.
Oh, and thank you.
Yeah.
And Rick Poon, my photographer, and my illustrator, Juliette Belloc, did a wonderful job. They're not Japanese, French and Thai. But you see, they have this shared love for Japan, and I was able to communicate what I needed.
Right. Well, one thing I felt about, you know, after you went through your book, you know, Japanese food is not Japanese. It doesn't belong to Japanese people anymore. It's more explored, kind of advanced by, you know, Japanese people, and which is amazing, wonderful.
Isn't
thing.
It amazing? Yeah, I was. I now have, you know, I go to a restaurant and there's dashi, you know, dashi infused something, and I'm going, wow, and there's wakame hidden under the spinach, or, and there's agar, and the chefs are very adventurous, and that did not happen 35 years ago. If I, you know, I remember being on a TV show here in New York, and I made miso soup for a morning show, and the host did not look so happy. I don't think he liked the smell of bonito flakes, you know, and I was like, okay, but this is how you make miso soup. And today, it's completely different.
Right.
Yeah, people love it.
Well, some non-Japanese chefs know way more than I do about how to utilize koji or those.
I know. Isn't it incredible? Right. I get kind of intimidated.
Me too. Okay, so what's your suggestion for our listeners who've never thought of cooking Japanese food if they found your book and then tried something?
Well, my book is spends a lot of time in the pantry. You know, you will see that it's the big chunk of it is about understanding ingredients, because I don't want you to walk into a Japanese market and not understand this soy sauce from another soy sauce or wakame from a kombu seaweed. I think you have to get some understanding of it. So I explain that and as much as I can. So you read through that, and then I show you fundamentals of cooking a stock. Stock is so important. If you're Japanese, and stock is called dashi, but you begin cooking with stock. In Western cooking, you probably would fry up some onions and garlic and olive oil. It's more about starting with oil, I think. And I think there's a fundamental difference in how you approach food. So I want you to understand some of those basics. And the easiest way is to understand stock. And you could do a simple one by just doing a cold brew of kombu and just put it in a pitcher of water, a piece of kombu, and make dashi. And then add some miso paste and make a miso soup. It's simple as that. And, you know, 15 minutes, you have a soup. That's delightful. And people are really surprised. And so many of my students come and say, well, I grew up on dashi powder, you know, artificial dashi powder. Well, my mother used that too, you know. But I say, you know, it's so easy to make a simple stock. So let me teach you that. And I show them how to put these ingredients together. And in no time, they'll say, oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, especially Japanese dashi. So, you know, kombu and bonito flakes, they are classic, like two, you know, I don't know, like two biggest elements making dashi. But we don't have to spend time to make dashi, because craftsmen spend months and months to make dashi and the kombu and bonito.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I feel like I'm cheating. And everything's guaranteed. It tastes so much better than without.
Yeah.
Right. So again, the listeners, the title of the book is Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. So we'll talk about the links. Is it Amazon.com and available?
It's available in bookstores everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, and please go to the independent bookstores. I did actually, a lot of my work here in New York was to visit the bookstores, the independent bookstores, and Kinokuniya is another one, right? Japanese, and wonderful bookstores all over town, and they carry my book.
Right. It's a beautiful book, so best for Christmas present.
Oh, yeah, right. Don't forget.
So, okay, and I want to discuss the your being grain activist. So how did you become passionate about restoring ancient grains?
It wasn't really my idea. It's kind of my pursuit of just trying to find good flour led me to farmers and scientists and millers and one particular person, Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills in South Carolina, was somebody that has revived corn and rice of that region and really the southern larder. And I started a dialogue with him, and because he also grew buckwheat in the Appalachians. And I started testing his flours for soba, and we would just compare notes and talk about all these grains. And one day he flew out and he says, I have something important to tell you. And he says, you know, Southern California or California used to be a grain growing region of all these beautiful ancient grains, wheats, a variety of wheats, not just one wheat, not one modern wheat like they grow for yield in the Midwest, but these varieties of heritage grains and beautiful barley and oats and rye. And he encouraged me to start an experiment and finding a farmer who might want to grow it. So I had to find someone who was interested in organic or sustainable farming who would be willing to grow several rows of heritage grains and do that. And California is a very big agricultural place, but most people earn their living from growing fruit and vegetables. So that's the cash crop. So to do grains is not that economical in the beginning, but we encourage some like-minded farmers to start experimenting, and I found like five of them, and we started planting. You know, we actually got a donation of 4 tons of ancient grains of four or five varieties of wheat and barley and buckwheat, and we planted them. Wow. He even gave me a combine.
Wow.
Can you believe it? A combine, a vintage combine. It was kind of a fun experiment. And 10 years later, there are farmers growing it. And now we have grains and flour available at the farmers market and in Southern California and available to chefs. So that's a remarkable, I think, success in a small scale. But it's also a crop that farmers are using as a rotation crop. So that's good for the soil. And our ultimate goal is to restore the health of our soils.
Right. And also, ancient grains are more kind of nutritious, people say. So,
I don't know about the nutritional value, but I you know, compared to like GMO, but you know, there's no GMO wheat. There's GMO soybeans, right? So we really don't know how GMO soybeans affects our body. But I just don't want things to be altered.
Right.
Yeah. But there was all kinds of people breeding ancient grains or breeding modern grains. But anyway, I like the idea of restoring some good old flavors and also diversifying the way you grow, because you don't want to just grow one thing. And that's what's happened to our country. You just go one kind of wheat, one kind of corn, and depleting the health of the soils.
Right. Well, eventually it depletes our nutritious components in our body too.
Oh, yes. And so industrial farming is not good.
Right. Well, luckily, chefs like Dunbarber or Sean Brock and, you know, those great activists are there, but it's not enough. So.
It's not enough. And I think it has to start, the choice can be made by a home cook. You know, I'm not a farmer planting buckwheat, or I'm not a farmer doing all these, the hard work, but you could be the consumer.
Right.
And choose to pick, you know, flour made by the farmer in your local neighborhood. Because that's different from the industrial flours that sit on the shelf for you don't know how many years.
Right.
And you will taste the difference in the flavor of something freshly milled versus something that is made for yield and shelf life.
Right.
Yeah.
That is so true. I just happened to try freshly milled rice, not the the rice imported from Japan, like that milled like month and month ago.
Yeah.
It's much heavier. Yeah. And juicier and more flavor. So yeah. I exactly understand what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. And I'm curious about, so, you know, the grains can be very different, minerally different. And, you know, all those nutritious values really provides different taste too.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah I'll be really excited to try.
Yeah. And this, you know, just at the bread lab in Washington alone, I work with a bread lab, like Dr. Scott Jones, Steve Jones. He breeds about 40,000 varieties of grains.
What?
Yes, 40,000. 40,000. And over 150 varieties of buckwheat. Mm. And there's actually a grain school that he conducts. And you could actually see the different variety patches of experimental fields at the lab. And a lot of them are planted for restoration.
Mm, wow.
And you get to taste the different grains. It's unbelievable. Different wheats. They look different, too.
Mm. Yeah. So what's the name of the lab you said?
It's the Bread Lab.
Bread Lab.
Yeah, it's been written a lot in the New York Times. And, but there's like also in Colorado, the University of Colorado does a grain school. And there's so grain schools in different places. Also in New York, there's groups that are getting together to talk about grains.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll definitely look up.
Yeah.
So we are kind of running out of time. So what are your plans?
Next.
Long time, short term?
Continue. Just continue what I do. Continue teaching and learning and writing. I just want to get through this tour and sell a lot of books. That's my primary goal, because it's like once you have a book that people like to have on their shelves, then they'll pull it out and they'll refer to me, and then they could come to my cooking class, or and then, you know, we'll see what I evolve into, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I hope to keep evolving.
Mm. Yeah. But you never know, right? Suddenly you decide to learn something, just like you learned soba making. You might.
Yeah, no. And I did curry, by the way. I don't know if you heard of my curry bricks, but I was so against the industrial curry.
Mm.
So I deconstructed the industrial roux and made my own curry bricks. And actually, that's become my most popular cooking class.
Wow. Because yeah. I like Japanese curry once in a while, but if you read the box, there's so many things.
It's horrible, right? So including palm oil, which I really do not like what's happening with the palm oil industry. So my curry brick does not have any of that. It's just, you know, it's a roux made with butter and flour and whole spices that I grind and toast, and I teach that in my classes to make a brick.
Right. So it's not sold anywhere?
No, not yet, but I did a pop-up at Marlowe & Sons yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
and it's been featured in the New York Times.
That's nice.
So you could actually go to the New York Times, or you could go to my cookbook, and that's where I make the introduction to my curry brick, and it's so much fun to work with whole spices.
Right.
See, that's the thing, is you want to work from whole foods, you know, whole grains, whole seeds,
right.
And you start looking at shapes and colors and smells, and
right.
That's what I want you to appreciate, you know, because then you know who you could appreciate, the person that grew it, and
right.
Or nature that gave it to us. And it's a gift, and you don't want to spoil it.
Mm. And also, I think by smelling it, you appreciate more, you enjoy more.
Yeah, I swear it by my curry bread.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try to make it myself.
Yes.
All right, so where can we find your updates, classes, and any other information?
Please visit sonokosakai.com.
Okay, so it's SONOKOSAKI.com, sonokosakai.com.
Yes.
Okay, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully you can come back and tell us more about what you're doing.
Yes, thank you.
There's so much going on with you.
Thank you, Aiko.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer, it's Amanda Wong, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.